Thank you so much. Well, thanks for the introduction. My name is Pamela. I talk a lot. I'm very impressed by my co-presenter's ability to get through the data and just get to the point. I'm going to try really hard to do that. I have no relationships to disclose. And I want to thank the Ms. Foundation for Women, which funded this project, as well as our previous work on child sexual abuse. And I want to thank the people who co-wrote this presentation with me, Andrew Shane, who's presenting elsewhere, Priscilla Gonzalez, who's no longer with us at Berkeley Media Studies Group, and Heather Gellert, our wonderful copy editor, without whom nothing. So for those folks who are not familiar with the Berkeley Media Studies Group, I want to give a little bit of overview. I think I've seen some of you at presentations at the Berk before, so I'll try not to repeat too many things. We are based in Berkeley, California, just across the bay. We're a project of the Public Health Institute, and we have kind of a three-headed focus. We research how the news covers public health issues to develop media advocacy training and strategic consultation for community groups and public health advocates who seek to change the way the news is talking about those issues. We also provide professional education for journalists who want to write about public health and safety issues using that public health and prevention lens. We're often asked why it is that we focus on the news. Of all the different areas of public health, why the news? And it's really because the news does so much to shape the agenda, to determine what issues we're talking about. Obviously, in this election year, we see that. And also what issues we're not talking about. It also puts on the agenda, or it also affects how we think about those issues, including what kinds of solutions we see or don't see. This is jumping ahead of me a little bit, I'm sorry. The kinds of solutions that we see or don't see on the agenda, the kinds of things that we are or aren't talking about. And of course, this is an election year, so we see to a great extent the impact that the news has on our policymakers. Not only do the decision leaders who shape the environment in which we live and work and do our prevention, hopefully, and intervention work, not only do they learn about the issues through the news, as do we all, but they also learn through the news what issues are most of interest to their constituents and what solutions are most acceptable. So the news has this tremendous role to play in putting things on the agenda, but also shaping how we think about those issues, both us and policymakers. And ultimately, what we find in a lot of cases, oh dear, my Y's got kind of thrown off, but is that overwhelmingly, the news about a number of issues, including child sexual abuse, as we found in our previous studies at Berkeley Media Studies Group, really overwhelmingly focuses on personal responsibility. What does that mean when we're talking about, in this case, child sexual abuse? I'm not an expert in other areas of violence prevention, but this is a pattern we observe in coverage of a lot of issues. Focuses really, really heavily on individual cases, individual stories, this perpetrator, this survivor, this, you know, arrest, arraignment, or trial. By contrast, there's very little focus on the institutions that have a role in, that may have a role in, oops, sorry, again, I'm used to being able to click and this just wants to jump ahead. There's very little focus in the news on the institutions, right? Our, as you'll probably guess from the title, our universities, our organizations that work with youth, our foster care system, et cetera, that have a role to play in implementing the kind of systemic or environmental policies that could act to prevent child sexual abuse after it happens, before it happens, rather than reporting only on the criminal justice aspects after the fact. Okay? So it's not to say that there's not a role for both kinds of coverage and both kinds of stories and both kinds of accountability, but really overwhelmingly what we're seeing in the news is that criminal justice focus on individual cases and actors. So what had happened was that we had done this study, which some of you may have read, called Case by Case, Child sexual abuse in the news. We saw this split heavy focus on personal stories, individual cases, kind of personal accountability on however level we're defining that. Very little focus on the institutions that might have a role to play in changing the environments in which child sexual abuse happens. And then, in late 2011, a story broke that really kind of took this whole story of institutional accountability very much to the forefront of the news. And that story was, I'm a walker when I talk, so this is very hard for me, but I'm trying, I promise. This was the story of the arrest of Jerry Sandusky, the former defensive coordinator for the Penn State football team, on multiple counts of child sexual abuse. The story broke in November of 2011 after a grand jury report was filed in the state of Pennsylvania. And of course, in the ensuing months and ensuing weeks, there was a tremendous amount of coverage, not only of Sandusky himself, but also of the storied head coach, Joe Paterno, and of the culture of football at Penn State that had, in the words of the media, allowed the abuse to take place over a number of years, since Sandusky was alleged and later shown to have committed a number of abuses on the Penn State campus, to which he continually had access. So we were interested in looking at how this story fit into this institutional versus personal responsibility paradigm, and how it compared to earlier research that we'd done on child sexual abuse in the news. To do that, we studied the newspaper and sports page coverage of Penn State that was published in the first 9 days after the grand jury report was filed. And those 9 days, which was basically a week plus weekends bracketing each end, encompassed a number of high-profile events in this case. So we saw not only the filing of the report and Jerry Sandusky's arrest, but also the announcement of Paterno's resignation, his subsequent firing, as well as that... Stop. I have a toddler, so sometimes I just think if I just tell it firmly enough, it'll do what I want. Not only Paterno's announcement of his resignation, but his subsequent firing and the riots that occurred on the student campus over the firing, as well as finally, as kind of a cap to our study period, the first home game at Penn State after the abuse came to light. I'll be very happy. I'm a research nerd, as you heard. I did 2 different masters at Berkeley just because I couldn't get enough of research. So if anybody would like to talk to me about methods or get a link to the paper afterward, I'm very happy to talk about all the different things that we did to select and analyze this sample. But what I think probably most folks are interested in, especially at 9 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday, is just what did we find? You know, what were some of the key results? So again, this is just a sampling of things we're going to talk through, but again, if you want to talk to me afterward, I will talk your ear off. So the first thing we asked was, you know, who dominates the coverage? All right, and so this, I think, is just a quick table that sort of introduces the key actors for anybody not familiar with the story, you know, anybody who was asleep for 4 months in late 2011. And, of course, in the both in the news and the sports pages, the key actor was Joe Paterno, who had been the winningest coach in... and I'm not a sports person, Giants, forgive me, but in, I believe it was the Big Ten, in, he was the winningest coach in college football. How about we just put it that way? I'm a little away from the sports facts now. He dominated. This was stories about what he had done, what he had known, his history, his future on the team, what it meant for, what his legacy meant for the school and the town. Other key stories focused on Penn State culture. What was the football culture at Penn State that had, quote-unquote, allowed this to happen? And on that note, there were questions about the Penn State officials, namely the former university president and athletic director. And again, there are questions about what they had known, what they hadn't known, what they had or hadn't tried to do, what their future at the school and in the town would be. Criminal justice made up about 10% of both news and sports stories, and that was things like what had the filing of the grand jury report looked like, where was Sandusky in the arrest process, etc. I'm sure we can most of us imagine what a criminal justice story about any instance of abuse tends to look like. And finally, of course, a significant chunk of the sports news was dominated by questions about what this meant for the team. interviews with current and past players and coaches, conversations about the team as they went into team and fans, indeed, as they went into and out of that that first home game post arrest. Now, one thing you'll notice here that people always ask me when I present this slide is, well, where are the victims? And that, I think, is a really valuable question. And the answer is that they did not dominate the coverage. And when we looked through, I can't present these findings today, much as I'd love to, because there's just too many of them. When we tried to go through, like, how are different actors on this list talked about? How does the news characterize them? What we found was that overwhelmingly there were references to hearts going out to the victims and sympathy for the victims. But that was the only reference to them. And otherwise, the news was very much dominated by these actors, Joe Paterno, the team, to a lesser extent, Jerry Sandusky and his place in the criminal justice process, et cetera. So it's not by accident that the victims are not, or the survivors, excuse me, and I know that, that preference as far as terminology varies, so I'll try to go with survivors, I'm sorry, that the survivors were largely absent from this coverage. And some of that may also be the fact that this was so new and that there were several privacy concerns that were ongoing throughout Sandusky's trial and conviction. But I think it really is worth noting that these actors are very much absent from any coverage. The interesting thing, I think, is about accountability. This is a quote that showed up all the time in the news coverage, both in the news and the sports coverage. This is from Pennsylvania State Police Commissioner Frank Noonan, who says, somebody has to question what I would consider the moral requirements for a human being that knows of sexual things taking place with a child. Whether you're a football coach or a university president or the guy sweeping the building, I think you have a moral responsibility to call us. Now, what an incredible statement that is, coming on the heels of so much research that we've seen and we've done, showing that overwhelmingly we're on that other side of the scale, where we're talking about this actor, this perpetrator, this priest or Boy Scout leader or any number of other authority figures or parent or uncle who committed this act, and he or she alone is responsible. And here we're seeing, there's definitely, I don't want to say this is the only accountability discussion that happened in the news, but this was such a persistent theme throughout, the idea that there's an institution and an institution that failed children. This is another area. Now, I'm the child of an English teacher, God help me, and I'm also I was an English major for a while in an undergrad, a period best forgotten. So I'm really interested in language. And one of the things that we had really found interesting during our first study of CSA, which I again hope folks will read if you haven't already, was the vagueness and imprecision of language describing CSA. And of course, there are legal and journalistic precedents for that, but it is still a fact that a lot of times language around CSA can be quite difficult to parse in the news. Well, here in the coverage of Penn State, we saw that there was the availability of that grand jury report, which contained a great deal of specific and precise testimony about Jerry Sandusky's actions. And we observed that many, many articles in our sample quoted that grand jury report extensively, and indeed 80% of the stories used some kind of language that accurately conveyed the criminal nature of the acts, whether describing it as rape, a sex crime, or going into some of the more specific terminology from the grand jury report. This was a really startling finding, coming from previous studies where we had seen much more language that kind of pulled back and left a lot of room for interpretation or euphemism in the coverage. Now, we did see about 20% of stories that referred much more obliquely and did not use that grand jury report testimony or tended to use many more vague and pulled back terms. One of my favorites was a statement from the College Sports Association itself, which referred to the Sandusky incident. Okay, so again, language that kind of lets us all pull back and leaves a lot of room for interpretation about what it was that actually happened. But that was the clear minority of the coverage. And by and large, reporters were really taking advantage of having this kind of clear and specific testimony to talk in more explicit, though not prurient, terms about the criminal activities that had occurred and been inflicted on the survivors. And finally, I want to talk about prevention. That's why we're all here. That's why I think a lot of us are in public health. Well, this is pretty typical that solutions, any kind of solution, was pretty well absent in the general news coverage. So that's intervention or prevention. Largely absent. When solutions did show up, they were usually, you know, arrest Sandusky or keep him in jail forever. Okay. But we also analyzed statements from CSA advocacy groups. And this is one of, I think, kind of the happy endings or like the fairy tale endings in public health, was that it was such a real inspiring thing as somebody who researches the news and researches coverage and researches child sex abuse in the news specifically, to see how many CSA advocacy groups, including Prevent Child Abuse America, including Darkness to Light and Stop It Now, including a number of grantees from the Ms. Foundation doing work around child sexual abuse advocacy. These statements addressed a broad variety of CSA issues. They really used this high-profile incident to springboard to larger conversations about CSA and about the need for prevention. And they, you know, focused on solutions, of course, on talking about institutional accountability and holding the school and the actors therein accountable, but also in a much broader sense talking about prevention at all levels, individual, family, institutions, high-level policy, et cetera. And in doing so, they focused on the safety of all children. They talked not only about the survivors at Penn State, but also how do we ensure that this never happens again? How do we prevent another Penn State? And that was a recurring theme throughout the statements that we analyzed from CSA advocacy groups, and it was a really remarkable thing to see. But of course, we want to talk about this first bullet point here now. Solutions, prevention, were pretty well absent in the general news, and that is something that, as I said, we've seen before. We've seen in coverage of CSA and quotidian, in day-to-day coverage. So I think one of the questions for advocates is really, you know, how do we get prevention in the news? How do we put prevention in the news? And this is a comic strip that was published pretty shortly afterward. I'll talk you through it really quickly. So it said, remove football records, remove trophies, remove Joe Paterno's statue. So, you know, this was a comic that was published, I think, within the last couple of months because his statue was only removed recently. And then finally, the final panel, remove the potential of this happening again by using this money for child abuse prevention programs. Okay, so great. So we're seeing the beginnings, some months later, of prevention kind of inching its way into the news through the sports pages, through cartoons. But when I presented this research at the Institute on Violence, Abuse, and Trauma conference in San Diego a couple of weeks ago, I don't know if any of you were there, but it was a great conference, a woman in the audience raised her hand and said, yeah, that's great, but again, this is still all talking about the football team. You know, this is still hinged on the football team. Yes, prevention is getting in the news, but how do we keep it there, and how do we pull that focus back even further to talk about prevention in a larger context, getting away from hinging on that kind of hook of the football team, of Joe Paterno, on Penn State's football records? Well, that's a really good question. I wish that I had magic words to give everybody. But what I do have is some ideas that we've formulated and that we're continuing to work on, and that I hope folks here with more experience in the hands-on advocacy will give us feedback on how advocates can use the media to reshape the conversation around child sexual abuse, creating room in that conversation for prevention. Okay. So again, these are some things that we've worked on. But again, I look forward to just more feedback, more questions and answers in the discussion. One of the things we always say is monitor the media. You know, you can't change the media conversation unless you know what the media is saying about your issue, right? So this is the New York Times Magazine. This was a very high-profile story that came out a few months ago about abuse in a prep school in New York City, I believe. Yes. And this offered an opportunity for advocates to talk. You know, the story is already in the news. That makes it much easier to bring your perspective to the news, to widen that conversation, to create news, or to piggyback off of an existing story like this. But, you know, I think this is a really powerful image, but sometimes I hesitate to use it because I think it conveys the impression, well, we can only talk about child sexual abuse if there's a story already in the news about institutional failure, or, you know, about a school or a sports program. That's not necessarily the case. You know, there's a lot of different stories that come through the news that we monitor, that we've seen advocacy groups and worked with advocacy groups to monitor, that offer an opportunity to springboard to larger conversations about that leave room for prevention and that aren't just hinging on a particular high-profile sports or criminal justice hook. Okay, so for example, a couple of months ago, there was a lot in the news about the use of underage models proposed provocatively and scantily clad in high-fashion advertisements. This is in no way related to, you know, an institution failing young men in its care, but it did offer advocates an opportunity to talk about the sexualization of children in our culture and the normalization of that pattern. So again, I kind of introduce that as just an example to say it doesn't always have to be this glaringly obvious, and it doesn't always have to be on the front cover of the New York Times Magazine to offer a valuable opportunity to talk about or to create news that talks about prevention, that talks about the need for institutional and environmental policies, as well as direct service and those other interventions. Contributing to opinion space, certainly, again, it's election year. We see everybody out there writing op-eds and writing editorials, writing blog posts, and that's a great opportunity for advocates to use that space. I always say media advocacy is not necessarily always an issue of getting to Obama in the White House. Sometimes it starts with writing an op-ed or writing a letter to the editor that talks in a larger sense about the need for prevention policies, the need for prevention in general, the need for talking about what institutions can do, as well as families and individual providers. And that kind of leads, I jumped ahead of myself and got to my final bullet point of talking about systems and context. You know, so much of the news, not just about child sexual abuse, but about a number of different areas of family violence are so contingent on that criminal justice frame and on that idea, that can, for a lot of folks, convey the idea that this isn't a problem that is only up to criminal justice providers to deal with after the fact. And we have an opportunity to really expand that conversation and show the role of advocacy organizations and of providers along a full spectrum of service to prevent this from happening as well as to treat it after the fact. And finally, a couple of last recommendations that I want to make that were really specific, or conversations I want to have, I guess, that are really specific to our findings is, first of all, about developing relationships with journalists. Every time, I'm about 90% sure somebody in this room is going to say, well, it's not really up to me because it's about what the journalist writes. Or, you know, how am I supposed to change the conversation when the beat reporter at my local paper is the one writing this? And again, there's two sides to it. No one advocate can single-handedly change the conversation. But by building those relationships with journalists so that you are the person they come to for a soundbite, for a visual, for a comment, when a story about child sexual abuse or any level of family violence happens in the news, that's one way to start expanding that conversation and start building bridges between the two sides of the, you know, family violence in the news relationship. Another thing, continue research on how best to talk about child sexual abuse. And I don't just say this so that somebody will come offer me a lot of money to study this, my pet project, although that would help. This is an evolving area. As you saw that slide I showed with the jumble of words, this is something where I don't have the magic words to say that will necessarily determine how best to talk about CSA in a way that conveys the criminal nature of the acts without being prurient, without re-victimizing the survivors by, you know, and that is a very real fact, that there are privacy, there are legal, and there are journalistic rules that govern how we can talk about it, but there's a lot of room still to figure out how we can be precise and specific without, again, being prurient, without re-victimizing, without breaking any of those rules that I talked about. And finally, the last thing I just want to say is that, you know, I was so heartened and thrilled by those statements from advocacy organizations. They were wonderful. Most of them were not released until significantly after our study period. So many of those wonderful statements that I saw, that we saw, that contained so much powerful language about prevention, that contained so many strong policy recommendations across a number of levels, they weren't released until significantly after that that first flush of media coverage had happened. And that means that those conversations were left out of the media dialogue, by and large. I mean, they were in our study, but that's because we're research nerds. So this is just something. And of course, it's very challenging in an organization to create those statements, to craft them, to make sure that they represent the organization, and to release them in a timely manner, particularly with an involving story. But this is just something to be aware of, that it's so crucial to have your conversations about prevention and institutional responsibility be part of the media conversation. And that is about all of these different recommendations, but particularly about working to just on a level of timing and a level of getting those stories out there into the news. Well, I want to close with a big thank you. Again, you've been wonderful. I know I talk a lot and I talk kind of fast, but I'm just very passionate about this, and I'm so thrilled and honored to be in a room of people who are doing this kind of work and who can hopefully continue to give us feedback on how to better craft these recommendations and these suggestions for advocates, and who hopefully I'll be working with in the future to continue to expand this research and to continue to expand how we talk in the media about child sexual abuse and about family violence prevention along the entire spectrum. So thank you again. If you'd like to read this memo as well as our earlier piece on day-to-day coverage of child sexual abuse in the news, please visit our website or come grab a business card from me afterward, and I'll be very, very happy to send it to you along with any of the resources that I presented today. Thank you so much.